Well, good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and what an honor it is to have as our guest Judge Andrew P. Napolitano. Judge Napolitano was a former judge of the Superior Court of New Jersey. He's, of course, the senior judicial analyst for Fox News Channel, author of 9 books. His most recent book, quite an extraordinary work. I guess I could say that about all his previous books are all extraordinary, but this one really impresses me, Judge. It's called Suicide Pact, Radical Expansion of Presidential Powers and the Lethal Threat to American Liberty. And Judge, of course, this is a great scholarly work. It's thoroughly documented. It's a brilliant legal and political analysis of what the heck is going on in this country. But, you know, you are unique, it seems to me, in this sort of writing for your narrative power. I mean, this book, just for anybody who's interested in history and, again, what's happening to this country, this is an essential book, but it's a fun book. It's a serious book, but it's a fun book, and it carries you right along in the most extraordinary fashion. You're a great storyteller, Judge, in addition to all your other qualifications.
Well, you're very kind and generous to characterize this book that way, but it is the goal of the book to be a popular manual for the public, not for federal appeals court judges or law school faculty, so hopefully they too will find something of interest in there. So if you tell the story in an interesting way, people come back for more. And quite frankly, I think the ability to tell a story on my part comes either from my years as a law school professor explaining complex constitutional theory to what are effectively very bright young lay people. They're law students at the time, they're not lawyers. Or my years on the bench explaining the law to jurors who are quintessentially lay people and not lawyers, and you have to find a way to make the law be sensible and digestible and understandable and usable by them. So I appreciate you saying that. But the thesis of the book requires an analysis of American history, because the thesis of the book in a nutshell is when a president violates the Constitution or breaks federal law and gets away with it because he has demonized his opponents and it is temporarily popular, that behavior often results years later in the loss of liberty by those who weren't even around to applaud or condemn the president's behavior, because it is used as a precedent by future presidents. So when the president's unlawful behavior is unpunished and uncorrected, who could punish or correct it? Well, the Congress, the courts, public opinion. When the president's unlawful behavior is unpunished or uncorrected, then that becomes precedent for future presidents. I walked into a hornet's nest on this earlier this week with my colleague Bill O'Reilly. And I obviously knew what was in that hornet's nest for me, and it's his show. I can't grab the microphone from him. But we got into a real row over the morality and the lawfulness of President Obama's use of drones to kill people. And O'Reilly, of course, said, "You're hiding behind the Constitution." Well, how can you hide behind the Constitution when you are the President of the United States of America, who's taken an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution? But as aggressively as I argued against George W. Bush, who believed that by bringing American prisoners to Guantanamo Bay, he could escape the Constitution and thereby torture them, or by not going to any court whatsoever, he could just unleash the NSA to spy on Americans, and if they got actionable intelligence information, he'd be applauded. These two behaviors pale in comparison to Barack Obama's argument that he can kill Americans if it's difficult to arrest them. Yet he used as a part of his legal argument the uncorrected, unpunished behavior of George W. Bush in the arguments that he made as to why he could escape the Constitution. So this happens all the time. I mean, when George Washington's generals were chopping off the heads of colonial soldiers who decided to go home, you know, there was no draft. It was a volunteer army. It sort of set the pace that the commander-in-chief in wartime can make an argument that from some source other than the Constitution, because there was no Constitution at the time, he gets the powers to do extraordinary things. And yet John Adams and the Alien and Sedition Acts and Abraham Lincoln, of course, that's sui generis, but that's the most extraordinary presidential destruction of innocent life in American history. And you have, you know, Woodrow Wilson arresting people for reciting the Declaration of Independence in public and singing German songs, and FDR confiscating the gold, and LBJ making up the Gulf of Tonkin, and Bush spying and torturing, and Obama killing. You see the pattern. You see how it gets worse and worse. And in each of these presidencies, he uses as a basis to justify its unlawful behavior the uncorrected pattern of its predecessors.
Judge, has the presidency become an elective dictatorship?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. You know, one of the best descriptions of the presidency I ever heard was from you, which was that the president should not be a person who's in our faces every day and trying to tell us how to live. He should merely be the discreet and humble behind-the-scenes CEO of the executive branch of the government, making sure that it did efficiently, but only the 16 things it is authorized to do in the Constitution. But of course, we have a prince today, and this is not Barack Obama's doing. Barack Obama, who is the target of furious assaults by members of Congress, should basically say to them, you know, you voted to give to my predecessor the powers that I am now exercising, and you don't like the way I'm exercising them, yet you gave the presidency all this extraordinary discretion. Now think about this. Every president since World War II has killed foreigners without a declaration of war, and none was stopped, sanctioned, corrected, punished, or reversed by the Congress, the courts, or the people. And each time this is done, whatever president it is, whether it's Truman or Obama or any of the half dozen or so between them, has more self-confidence in his ability to do this. I mean, when in the spring of 2009 or 10, I don't remember when it was, when Congress was on spring break and Barack Obama was in Brazil, and he got on international television from Brazil and said, "We're bombing Libya," he basically was stealing power from the Congress by declaring war on Libya. Of course, what he was really doing was using American planes to destroy American military equipment on the ground that American munitions manufacturers had lawfully sold to the government of Libya and had been paid for by American dollars that we had given to the government of Libya. I mean, this is as circular as you can imagine it being. The result, of course, is that Libya goes into chaos. Gaddafi is killed. 2 years later, our own ambassador is murdered because there is no order in the streets. Did anybody do anything about this? The Congress, the courts, or the American public? No. Why? Because by this point in our history, to your question about whether the president is an elected dictator, we expect presidents to do these things, and we forget about it 2 or 3 days later.
No, it just seems it seems the norm, and of course, this is why, regarding an earlier point you made, that one of the very first decisions of the Obama administration was to say was to approve of everything the Bush administration had done, including things that some of his own supporters thought he might bring legal charges for all the various crimes and misdemeanors of the Bush administration. He approved it all because, of course, he wanted to build on it.
Well, you know, there's this brewing scandal. It's a little tawdry. I'm not going to go into the details, involving a hedge fund billionaire by the name of Jeffrey Epstein and his pension for girls that are under the age of consent and having sex with them, and the allegations that he provided these girls to Prince Andrew, and allegations that Bill Clinton was present. There's no allegations that I'm aware of involving the former president. And Jeff Epstein was about to be charged by the federal government with 30 counts of what's called white slavery, basically transporting underage women for sexual purposes, either into the U.S. out of the U.S. or between states. Each of those carries a 20-year term. So you're talking about a potential 600-year term. Suddenly, the deal was cut that he would not be charged with anything in any federal court, and he would silently be allowed to plead guilty to one count of patronizing a prostitute, and he would serve 8 months of a 13-month term, which consisted of sleeping in a jail. He could still be in his house during the day. This was done by the Bush Justice Department for a prominent Democratic fundraiser and good buddy of the former President Bill Clinton. Now, why would the Bush Justice Department want to confer a favor on somebody like this? Because it would expect a similar favor for its own excesses from the Obama Justice Department, just as Obama will expect these favors from fill in the blank, whoever succeeds him in the White House. And he will get those favors unless the person who succeeds him is Rand Paul.
Well, this is Judge, a friend of mine, I was telling him about your book, and he said, where does the title Suicide Pact come from?
It's a phrase that I chose to tweak the congressman Peter King's and Senator Lindsey Graham's and Vice President Dick Cheney's of the world, who love to throw around the phrase, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And to them, that means that when push comes to shove, our liberties must defer to the government's demands and claims of safety. It is basically a rejection of the idea in the Declaration of Independence, in federal law, and in Jeffersonian and Lockean literature, in Thomistic theology, in Judeo-Christian teaching, that our rights are natural and come from our humanity. If the simple articulation of the phrase, the Constitution is not a suicide pact, is a justification for the government seizing our liberty, then they are revealing their hands that our liberty does not come from our humanity. They believe it comes from the government. The phrase itself was used in a very famous dissent in a Supreme Court opinion, a dissent that has never become the majority and has never been followed. And I couldn't resist the temptation of taking the neocons, one of their favorite phrases, and using it against them. Case in which the dissent came had to do with what's called the heckler's veto. When a speaker is giving a speech and he is heckled down, and the police don't arrest the hecklers, they arrest the speaker for arousing the hecklers. That's obviously the opposite of what the police are supposed to do. But in a famous case in Chicago in 1949, where the speaker was a Roman Catholic priest giving some very strident criticism of the Truman administration, and his critics showed up and stormed the stage, and he barely escaped with his life. Instead of arresting the people who stormed the stage, they arrested the priest, who was convicted in a Chicago trial court and upheld in the Chicago appeals courts and reversed by the Supreme Court of the United States in a very, very strong opinion, reaffirming the fact that the First Amendment needs breathing room, meaning you can stand on the soapbox and arouse the crowd, and if they attack you, they get arrested, not you. But in the dissent in that case, Justice Robert Jackson used the phrase suicide pact. It's a totally discredited phrase, but I couldn't resist tweaking our neocon friends, some of whom have offices within a few feet of where I'm now seated. The record will reflect I lowered my voice a few octaves. I couldn't resist tweaking them by making that the title of the book. And you might not even remember this. The whole reason I wrote this book is because in one of our many happy conversations, you, Llewellyn Harrison Rockwell Jr., suggested this book to me. Well, because you've been a champion for monitoring dictatorial powers that presidents claim. Where does it come from? How bad is it? And the history is terrifying. I mean, the concluding line of the introduction of this book is, beware, this does not have a happy ending. The book doesn't have a happy ending, and the march towards presidential dictatorial powers does not have a happy ending, at least as of this moment.
Well, if we're wanting to bring about a happier ending, if we're wanting to incite the American public in the best possible way as to what's happening to their freedoms and really what the government is attempting to do to human nature. I mean, this is a very, as you point out, an extremely radical attack on everything good what the American presidency has become. If people are concerned about this, as they certainly ought to be, if they're worried about the future, read this book. I mean, this will arm you in your arguments and your own thinking. It's really the best thing you can do for yourself if you were concerned about these powers, if you're concerned about what's happening with the presidency. Read Suicide Pact, The Radical Expansion of Presidential Powers, and The Lethal Threat to American Liberty. And again, this is not a job to read this book. You will love this book once you start it. You will finish it. It will inform you, inspire you, exhilarate you, and help you get to work for the right things. So Judge Napolitano, thanks a million for writing this book. Thanks for everything you do in your life to inspire us and to exhilarate us. And thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for chatting with me today, Lou. All the best to you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.